Robin and I had been married a couple of years, and the apartment we were living in had been a small furnished apartment, as we didn't have any furniture, but we had, I think at that time, by those couple of years, had bought some bedroom furniture and a couch and a sofa. And the a lady that taught, her room was pretty much, I think, next to my room in the school where I taught. And Dorothy was approaching retirement and lived by herself. And the apartment next to hers came open, and she wanted us to move in. And it was a much nicer apartment than we had, and had more room. But the problem was, it wasn't a furnished apartment, and we only had a sofa with a matching chair and bedroom furniture, and you had to buy a refrigerator because the apartment didn't have a refrigerator, so we'd have to buy this refrigerator. But there wasn't any, table and chairs, and so we needed that. And she had a table, so we'd move in. She had this table she'd give us and these chairs that didn't match it, but anyway, we could have this. So we ended up moving in beside Dorothy and living in that apartment for a couple of years until it burned down. And that's a different story, though. But actually, the fire started on the other end of a four apartment complex, and totally destroyed that, things on that end, and progressively, got less and less. So the time it got to ours, we actually didn't have any fire damage. We had some water damage, but so nothing burned up. But anyway, we had this table, and then we later had used this table for several years, and we moved into a house in Brenham, and I decided to restore this table. It was an old table, very dark, very dingy looking, and so he took all the old varnish off, and restained this maple wood, and put this hand finish on it, and it's this beautiful maple table. But that's what restoration is about. It is bringing something back to the luster it was. If the concept is to restore, then it is to put it back in the position it was. It's to put it back in the glory that it had. It is to bring it back to that fulfillment, to that usefulness, to the beauty of what it once was. And, while it is totally different and doesn't necessarily follow the same lines and truly is not the same simple process, restoring a relationship is exactly the same concept. It is to put it back in view of what it was. So if you're talking about restoring a relationship, then implied is something's happened to that relationship. It's become dingy over the years. It's become darkened over the years. Or it's had something happen to it, and it's been marred, and it needs to some repair work on it. But it is to put it back in that luster, that limelight, the glory, the usefulness of what it once was. And that's exactly what it is when we come in our relationship with God. When something has happened and has marred that relationship, whether it has been a long, gradual process of time that has sort of darkened the covering, the finish on it has become dull and darkened, and it needs to be restored, or whether it's been something sharp and acute and has marred it, has broken that relationship. And so whether you're thinking the relationship with God as there's been an event that has occurred, and that event has been so significant that it has marred that relationship, or whether it's been a process, a time of moving away, so to speak, where the finish has become dull, the relationship needs to be restored. And that's what we want to talk about this morning. Psalm 32 is a psalm of restoration. It is a psalm of restoring one to a relationship that existed. The context of this psalm is not stated for us. It is often assumed that Psalm 32 is somewhat of a companion to Psalm 51. Psalm 51 is much more clear a psalm of David when David had sinned with Bathsheba. Following David's sin, and you recall in the accounts and the historical books that David, and as the scripture says, when kings go to war, David didn't go. It was the springtime as opposed to more modern day type of warfare, where wars might be fought year round. There were times to pull back because of harsh winters and so forth. And it was springtime. It was that time when the war would be picked up and continued. But David didn't leave. Something was going on with David. There was already a problem with David. And as David was around his palace, in the vantage point, the height of the palace, Scripture says, you know, he looked out and he saw a beautiful woman. And David moved into another dimension. Not only had he not gone to war, and the implication is that that's where David should have been, but not being where he should have been, now he sees something that he shouldn't have seen probably. At least he should have looked away, and instead he looked with lust, and David continued down that path, a path of sin. And Psalm 51 is that psalm of David specifically dealing with that sin. Many believe that Psalm 32 is a parallel to that in some sense, a companion psalm of forgiveness, but one that would not have been written immediately, but one a little more reflective after the fact. But really, Psalm 32 does not have to be a companion to 51 in any exact historical sense. There's no reason for us to think that that's the only time in David's life that there was a sin. But regardless of that, it is a psalm that deals with restoration. And it does it in a fourfold manner as we look through this psalm. We want to look at these four sections, because each section is very informative, very instructive to us. The psalm in the little title says it's a psalm of David. And it's a miskol, which is one of those Hebrew terms that we find in the Psalms that is not clearly explained anywhere. There's no clear definition. There are some indications along the lines of what it might mean. And perhaps this is a psalm that this term is used to be somewhat contemplative, somewhat instructive. That it's saying this is an instructive psalm, one that one should contemplate on in the sense of the instruction that it offered. But the psalm begins in this fourfold way of disclosing it by saying, or we might say it, it's the blessing of forgiveness. The first two verses focus on this blessing of forgiveness. So the psalm starts with the blessing. It starts with the highlight. It starts with telling us the glory of being restored. It says, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. How blessed. Or as some lexical aids and some of those people that study words and Hebrew words and specifically say, you know, this word, at times at least, appropriately would be translated happy. And that's what's in view here. Oh, how happy is the one who is forgiven. You know, the very first psalm starts off in a similar way. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. It's how happy is the man who does not follow the wicked but is in line with the Lord. Here is a little different focus. It's the one that something's happened and he has followed the way of the wicked. But how happy is he when he's been forgiven? You know, people that struggle with that aspect of being forgiven, or people who have not sought to be forgiven, very often are marked by things that would be described as anything but happy. They're depressed. They're guilt-ridden. They're stressed. They're anxious. There's all kinds of descriptive words, but happy would not be one. This one says, how happy, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. Actually, in this passage, we find three words, three key concepts that present the problem. The problem of the psalmist is presented in these three key words. The first, given in this passage we just looked at, verse 1, is transgression. Transgression. The next one coming up in the second half of the verse is sin. And then the third in the first half of verse 2 is iniquity. Three words broadly for sin. Transgression, sin, iniquity. Clearly the psalmist is using them in a parallel sense, and so there's a sense that they're all synonymous, that they have the same meaning. They're just different words as he goes through, but yet they all have a different nuance. And it's that different nuance that we want to look at for just a moment. Transgression, in its root meaning, is to rebel, to revolt, to transgress. That fundamental concept is a breach in relationship. When one revolts, when one rebels against it, there's a breach in that relationship when that happens. Here it has that idea of rejecting God's authority. That one transgress, that is, one rejects the very authority of God. It's primarily a rebellion against God's law, His covenant, His being, who He is. It's a rebellion against it. It's a summing up of all the misdeeds that occur and the fracture in that relationship. And so to transgress is to deliberately go against God. Since Erica is not here this morning, I'll use her as an illustration. Actually, Erica's never really been opposed to me bringing up illustrations involving her. Megan went through a period when it was definitely no, you did not refer to Megan. But Erica, is an interesting child in the sense that she has some of these things that just almost doesn't seem like it would fit her personality. And one of them was, all these accidents occurred with Erica. Erica, how did the curtains get cut up? I accidentally cut them with the scissors. Everything was an accident. Erica, how did this happen? It was an accident. I accidentally did this. And you're just kind of like, when you deliberately do something, it's not an accident. And that's the word transgression here. It's not that I accidentally went down this path. It's a rebellion. And that's the word, transgress. The second word is sin. Sin. Sin is to miss the mark. This is that classic Hebrew term, to miss the mark. Just one of the classic words for sin. In Judges 20:16, this word occurs in its positive use, and is speaking of these marksmen. And they are so accurate with their slingshots that they never miss their target. That's what the term in its literal positive sense is. It is to not miss that mark. Sin is that idea that you miss the mark. That there is a goal, there is a target, but you don't hit it. It's not so much that one intentionally misses the mark, as in the sense of transgression. It's one that we just fail to hit the mark. We fail to live up to God's standards. Someone has said here that sin, in that ultimate sense, is to miss the goal of life. It is as though there is a target, there is a mark, and it is God's goal for our life, and we miss it. That's sin. And then the third word here is iniquity. Iniquity. And the root concept here is to bend, to twist, thus to distort. So iniquity, as used here, has the idea of crooked behavior, perverse behavior, or simply iniquity. So iniquity is to distort, to twist, to go astray, to pervert something. So all three of them, in one sense, are synonymous. They all have a little nuances difference, but the psalmist uses three words for sin here. Whether it's transgression, and talking about a deliberate rebellion, whether it's sin missing the standard, or whether it is to have iniquity, to distort, to have a crooked behavior, to have a distorted, perverted approach to life. That's the problem. Any one of those three or all three of those would describe David, he's saying. Or he will say, at least. At this point, he's saying the person that has that dealt with is blessed. The person that has all those things dealt with is blessed, is happy. Just as he mentioned, there's three things to this problem, or this problem could be defined by these three concepts. So one could say that the provision is presented in three positive concepts. Three provisions are made. And those three are associated with all three of the words, and that is forgiveness, also covering, and then to not impute. So in verse 1 it says, how blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven. The word for forgiven, which is really intriguing, that even when you look in the New Testament, you clearly have words for forgiveness. They mean to forgive. And to forgive, in its most basic sense in the New Testament, is to release. But in the Old Testament, even though we find English words in our Bible that says to forgive, the Hebrew does not have as clear of a word for forgiveness as the Greek language did. And the word here, in its literal sense, isn't to forgive. Though one could argue the same thing in Greek, it's not really to forgive, it's to release. But here, this word means to lift up, to take away. And it forms that picture, which Hebrew is a very picturesque language. And that's what it is to forgive. It is to lift something up, to carry it away. In that sense, to remove. And so the picture here is of a transgression that's lifted up and that is carried away, that is removed away from your presence, that is removed away from God's presence. And so David writes, how blessed is he whose transgression is lifted up, taken away, removed, carried off. Secondly, it says, whose sin is covered. Whose sin is covered. The word means to hide, to conceal, to cover. Now, to cover up is used in the sense of to pretend or present that something never happened. It is to conceal from people the truth that something happened. And so we have cover-ups. Something occurred, somebody doesn't want anybody else to know about it, and so it is hidden. So the greatest political cover-up in our lifetime is Watergate. The actual break-in wasn't covered up. That was a known fact. Those people were arrested. But what was going on behind the scenes related to who they were, the connections to the Republican Party, that became the cover-up. So we're going to conceal it. We're going to hide it. We're going to act like it didn't occur. We don't want anybody to know the truth. That's a cover-up. That's not what's in view with the idea of to cover. To cover isn't in the sense of to cover it up, to pretend it didn't occur. It is to cover it over in a sense of to remove it, to conceal it in a, almost in the aspect of restoring. Is that God has placed our sins out of sight. That the heels are concealed by the clouds. They're out of sight. A few times I've been to Pasadena, and the very first time I went to Fuller Seminary on their campus, I was talking to somebody there before I made the trip, and it was going to be in February. I said, February was the best time to go to Pasadena because of the times of the years and the smog and the haze and stuff. I said, February is just beautiful, and you can see the mountains, and so you can stand on campus and you can see the mountains. You can go there in August, and you might be there all week and not see the mountains. The mountains are there, but they're concealed behind this haze. They're covered up. That's what this is. God has covered it up. It's not that He's hiding it, pretending it's not there, but it's out of view. It's not that He's just put some smoke up there so we can't see it. The picture would be that God has removed it. It's no longer in view. It's out of sight. It's covered in that regard. The third is to not impute. To not impute. To impute means to count, to reckon, to judge. And so not to impute would be that it's not reckoned against you. You're not judged because of it. It's not counted towards you. That you're not, in that sense, any longer responsible for it. It's not being attributed to your account. It's been removed, and there is that sense of it's taken care of. So this first blessing has to do with these problems, but also the provisions. That there's these threefold sense of sin, whether it's called iniquity or sin or transgression. God deals with it. God provides for it through forgiveness, through covering, by not imputing. And so the whole two verses say, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, in whose spirit there is no deceit. This last one is really not a fourth term for sin. It's a statement that when your sin is forgiven, when your sin is covered, when your sin is not imputed toward you, and there's no deceit about all of this, then you're blessed. And the contrary part is that somebody says, I have no sin. I didn't sin. That's not wrong. I'm this, I'm that. And there's this self-deception going on. They've convinced themselves, or they put themselves in the sense of rationalization, and so they see themselves as blessed, but they're not blessed. It's the one who actually has been forgiven, actually has had their sin covered, actually have not had iniquity imputed against them, and there's no self-deception involved, that's the one that's blessed. So to pretend that I didn't sin, to rationalize that it really wasn't sin, doesn't make you blessed. It's when the real acknowledgement of sin has taken place, and that the forgiveness is there, that one is blessed. Well, having made this opening, almost theological statement about forgiveness, David moves on to a personal testimony. A personal testimony. And he does this in a twofold way. First, it's a testimony of destruction. It's a personal testimony of destruction. In verses 3 and 4, he says, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night, thy hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fervor heat of summer. When I kept silent, when there wasn't confession, when there wasn't acknowledgement, when there wasn't a dealing with God, when there wasn't an upfrontness with who God is and what's gone on in life, David said, my body wasted away. Now, you can look at this passage and say, take it very literally and say, David is talking about physical illness here. Or you could say, the physical aspects are being used in a poetic sense. And since, once again, since it's poetic language, it all makes sense to say that he's just using the physical aspect to paint more of a picture poetically of what occurs in the soul and the mind and the spirit. But at the same time, as with Psalm 51, there's a lot to be argued for that David is being very literal here. That when he didn't acknowledge his sin, when he wanted to pretend that the sin didn't occur, that there was a real attack upon his body. That there was a loss in the physical aspects of who he was. He says, through my groaning all day long. And then the last one he says, and vitality was drained. And what a time of the year to think about that. It's just, you know, all these warnings. Watch TV and excessive heat warning comes on. You watch the news and they say, you know, if you're going to be outside, you got to drink this and you got to drink this and you got to be sure you take this much liquid in. Vitality was drained through this excessive heat of the summer. That's what sin's like. It drains one's vitality. It weakens one. It says, for day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. You know, that clearly could be a look at that of a discipline of God. That God disciplined. But you know, one of the things with these passages as you look at them is that at least at times, and I'm not trying to suggest that God would never discipline one by truly intervening, but sometimes there's no reason. There's no requirement of God to bring any judgment, any additional thing into your life. The very fact of having sin, having the broken relationship, and being in that position where you're too stubborn, too unwilling to acknowledge sin and deal with it, that it's so disruptive. That it's so destroying of one's life. It's as though God would be saying, well, there's no need for me to do anything else. You've made yourself miserable enough. And the psalmist is here in a state of misery. David is writing his testimony. He's like, my life was miserable. But notice implied in this is that even though his life is miserable, he's not changing. And we know that from Psalm 51 in that psalm and in the historical account given for us in the historical books, that David went months without ever dealing with his sin. And his sin wasn't a minor sin. He committed adultery and he committed murder. And you recall that the prophet came to David. And the prophet came up with this story. There's this rich guy that has all of these sheep. And his poor little neighbor over here has one little favorite sheep. One little lamb. And so the rich guy doesn't want to barbecue his lamb, and he goes across the street and gets the neighbor's lamb and barbecues it. And David is just outraged. How could anybody do something like that? That is despicable. And then the prophet says, you're the man. But it had been months before David would deal with it. And so in this psalm, it's somewhat similar. When I kept silent, I physically felt the impact of sin in my life. What does that look like in everybody's life? I'm not sure. Would it always be the same in everybody's life? I don't think so. But sin can have real physical problems. Can really present things in your life. Now, don't take that and say, you know, my wife said she wasn't feeling yesterday good yesterday, and I'm pretty sure that must be sin in her life. You don't draw these conclusions that because somebody is ill, because somebody has an illness, because somebody, has a disease, that they've sinned. But when you're looking at your own personal life and you're unwilling to deal with sin, you may find that there's some real physical fallout for you. Well, David moves on, having given a personal testimony of destruction, to a personal testimony of deliverance. A personal testimony of deliverance. In verse 5, in a threefold way, he says, I acknowledged my sin, I did not hide my iniquity, and I confessed my transgressions. Verse 5, David says, I acknowledged my sin to thee. First, notice that David is talking to God. To you, God, I acknowledge my sin. Now, God didn't need David, and God doesn't need you to inform him you've sinned so that he will be aware. It's not that type of acknowledgement. It's not to inform God because he's unaware. It is to acknowledge. God is already aware. The question is, are you going to own up to it? Are you going to acknowledge to God, yes, indeed, this was sin. Yes, indeed, this was rebellion. Yes, indeed, I missed the mark. He says, when I acknowledge. Number two, my iniquity I did not hide. When I didn't try to hide it anymore. And Jonah is one of the classic examples. And Jonah is not this person that we put up here and say, see, that's, wicked old Jonah. And I don't know, he's stupid Jonah. Why would he think he could do that? And Jonah's just this guy that was put in Scripture to illustrate what we tend to do. But it's very graphic, very visual. God says, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. And then Scripture is so specific there. Jonah, and if you were to look at it on a map in north and south, using that sense of up and down, it's there also. Nineveh's north, and Jonah goes south, down to the coast, to get on a ship that's going south. And actually, in that time period, where he's headed is the furthest place you can go. And he's like, I'm going to the edge of the world. And then when he gets on the boat, he goes down into the ship. I mean, you have these three downs here. He goes down to the port, on a ship going down to the city. That's the edge of the world. And then he goes down inside the boat. Jonah is hiding from God. And the psalmist says here, when I quit hiding, when I no longer hid my iniquity. And once again, it's not that God's not aware, but there's this owning up to it. There is this acknowledgement. There is this saying, Lord, this is sin. And then he moves on and he says, I will confess my transgressions. I said, so this is what he was looking at, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. So once again, there is this sense of confession. And confession is that sense of to acknowledge. It's not, there was sometimes in the New Testament word of confess, it's been said that it is to, the word means to agree with, so it's like to name the sin. And that really misses it. To agree with is very appropriate. Because that is to say, this act was sin. I agree with you, God, this was sin. Confession is that sense of acknowledging, agreeing, coming to the point where you recognize and you verbalize to God that, yes, indeed, this was wrong. And so David moves to that point. And then notice, in this deliverance, the very end, he was delivered. He said, "And thou didst forgive the guilt of my sin." When I did these three things, when I acknowledged, when I no longer hid, when I confessed, what was God's response? His response was to forgive. His response was to forgive. Well, so David talks about the blessingness of forgiveness. Then he talks about his personal life, a personal testimony. And then third, he moves into and he offers to us, to the audience, to all that's listening, an invitation to pray. An invitation to pray. Look at verses 6 to 8. He says, "Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not reach him." In this verse, even though the word stress is not used, you could look at in that last part, "surely in a flood of great waters," he's talking about in a time of great stress, in a time of great distress, one can come to God and pray. "Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to thee in a time when thou mayest be found." Surely, in a flood of great waters, they shall not reach him. That in this great stress, when everything seems to be overwhelming, when the floodwaters are flowing down, that you can call out to God and be delivered, and that the flood will not sweep you away. And then, having made that invitation to prayer, verse 7 is maybe perhaps the wording of the prayer. "Thou art my hiding place. Thou dost preserve me from trouble. Thou dost surround me with songs of deliverance." The wording of a prayer. And then verse 8 is more of a teacher's pronouncement, instruction. David says, "I will instruct you and teach you in the way which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you." So David gives us this invitation to prayer, almost in a sense a model prayer, if you would. And then his oracle, his devotion, his commitment to be an instructor, which he does that in Psalm 51 too. It says, he moves to the end of that psalm, it says, "As you forgive me, God, when you forgive me, I will instruct others, I will inform others, I will tell others of your wonderfulness." And then the psalm concludes in these last verses with a warning about stubbornness. A warning about stubbornness. Verse 9, "Do not be as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose trappings include bit and bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise, they will not come near to you." I'm not a horseman at all. I haven't ridden a horse in so long, and I don't really enjoy riding horses because I've never ridden them enough to know what I'm doing to enjoy it. I figured out a long time ago, if I don't really know what I'm doing, I don't enjoy doing things. But just an observation about horses is, when you see them around, most horses, is they avoid people. Now, there are those exceptions, but you go to these corrals where these horses are ridden all the time, and they go out to get them, those horses walk away from people. But when they get the bridle on them, they're very responsive. They're even responsive to idiots like me that know less than the horse does about riding. And the psalmist is saying that in that regard. The horse only responds, is only held in check by a bit and bridle. But he's looking at this horse or a mule as being stubborn. And the mule has, whether it's deserved or not, is that emblem of stubbornness. And in the context is when you're too stubborn to acknowledge that this is sin. Verse 10. Many are the sorrows of the wicked. But he who trusts in the Lord, loving kindness shall surround him. What a contrast. The wicked have all these sorrows, but the one who will trust in the Lord has loving kindness. And we saw that same concept in the psalm last week. That he who trusts in God, if you trust in God, if you trust in his loving kindness, here loving kindness, his mercy, his grace will surround you. Verse 11, be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous ones, and shout for joy, all you who are upright in heart. That is, those that have moved to that place where they're no longer in deceit, those that are not trying to distort things, those that come to God and seek restoration, exactly what it said at the beginning, how blessed. And here David says, be glad in the Lord. Rejoice. Shout for joy. Because you've had that restored relationship. One thing is certain about the Christian life is we're going to have these times that we rebel, these times when we miss the mark, these times when we misstep, these times when we deliberately go astray, these times when we distort the way. And during those times, there will be times when we respond very quickly, but there will also be times when we don't want to respond. When in our own stubbornness, we don't want to move back. And it's in those times that we will have sorrow. We may even have these physical problems. We may be described as our bodies wasting away. Your vitality may seem to be drained. God may have to bring some judgment in. But in that stubbornness, there's no glory, there's no happiness, there's no beauty. But restoration is possible when we acknowledge, when we confess, when we no longer hide, when we come to God and say, you're a gracious God. And none of this is occurring because I deserve to be forgiven. And one has to wonder, what is going on with the person that says, I cannot experience God's forgiveness? And there are these people that they say they just, you know, don't ever seem to be forgiven by God. There are two, I'm sure there are many possibilities, but two thoughts come to mind immediately for me. One is they're still dealing with their own self-deception. They want to be forgiven, but they're not at the point where they can truly acknowledge the sinfulness of their sin. They're really not going to acknowledge that what they did was all that wrong. It's that point of saying, well, it was a little wrong, but, you know, the circumstances were such that it's somewhat understandable, so God, go ahead and forgive me. And then they go, I wonder why I don't feel forgiven. The other one is a failure to grasp the grace of God, the loving kindness of God. Somehow seeing in this that I have to deserve it, I have to earn it, I have to do something that qualifies me to be forgiven. And it is amazing that someone could look back and say, I became a Christian solely by God's grace. There was nothing I could do to earn my salvation. There's nothing I could ever do to deserve to be saved. But now, as a Christian, the only way God is going to forgive me of a sin is if I deserve it. And somehow, some Christians can entertain those things. But this passage says, how blessed is the person whose sin is forgiven. The provisions for forgiving the sin are there. It becomes upon us to confess, to acknowledge, to no longer hide, to bring it before God and say, indeed, it was sin. And that forgiveness comes from God.